Hi everyone, welcome to Chinese Whispers. This is where we demystify the People's Republic of China. We are Amal and
Jyotsna.
We are foreign policy enthusiasts interested in understanding China.
Today we'll be talking about Hong Kong, the city-state, or China's special administrative region. Whatever you might want to call it, it has had its streets flooded with millions protesting Beijing's authoritarianism for the greater part of 2019.
So why Hong Kong? Why is Hong Kong such a unique case in the world? So it's a unique case because that it has a population which has been part of a British colony like India, and hence they're used to basic freedoms like free speech, right to assembly, etc. But they're also kind of in conflict with the CCP, which denies all these rights to its own people. And this conflict of ideas and this fear is very visible in the ongoing protests.
Yeah. So let's talk about how we'll go about this episode. We'll be covering several phases of Hong Kong's history, which are relevant to understanding how these protests have unfolded and how this antagonism towards Beijing has been created. We'll first talk about how Hong Kong became Hong Kong. Then we'll talk about the rise of the CCP and the history of Hong Kong between 1949 to 1997. You know, you could say that China and Hong Kong sort of coexisted in this period. And then we'll talk about the CCP's intrusion into Hong Kong and the controversial extradition law and the protests.
Awesome. So let's start with why Hong Kong is such an important city. Like, why not, let's say, Tianjin with such importance? And why is it under such controversy these days? So let's go back to the 1750s. Hong Kong is part of the broader Guangdong region and specifically the Pearl River Delta in southern China. So being closer to the western part of the empire, and that is more populated territories, that is India and Southeast Asia, it was the most heavily used trading location, not very dissimilar to Calcutta actually. You might ask that the eastern ports, or rather the northeastern ports, might also have been useful, but the only trading parts were Korea and Japan, which didn't have a lot of population and they were rather poor in the 1700s. So That's why the Guangdong area, that is the Pearl River Delta, has been a very important trading part for the Qing Empire or the broader China overall. So as described before, the Chinese emperors have always faced threats from commercial trading. They have repeatedly closed off the ports whenever they wanted because, or rather, whenever they faced a threat. So in this case, the Qianlong Emperor in 1760 faced a similar threat and instituted the Canton system, which limited trading into China from just one port, that is basically the Pearl River Delta. And it was all state-approved trading, which he allowed, that is from specific 13 factories in the Guangdong province. And the ports in the rest of China were actually closed. Port trading was banned. In the meantime, the Industrial Revolution was picking up in Britain. And as you know, those damn Brits were suckered for tea. So that's why they were buying lots of tea from China. But on the other hand, they could not sell enough to the Chinese. And they had a huge trade deficit. Kind of similar to today's trade war by Donald Trump. So they decided to make Britain great again. Well, just kidding. They decided to sell good quality opium to China. And their source of the opium was the recently colonized Bengal in India. Now, this did not go well with the Qing authorities, who started seeing that drug addiction was picking up in China. And they tried to ban opium within China. In fact, this same trade deficit was such an issue for the British that they tried to plant tea in their recently colonized territories to save on the trade deficit. We know those types of tea as Darjeeling and Assam tea today. So back to the Qing Empire, they banned opium trade, but the British continued smuggling opium and tried to contravene the Chinese laws. And actually that makes Pablo Escobar look like a toddler. So now, the Qing tried to enforce that ban by confiscating opium. And the next thing you know, the Brits came down with their technologically superior ships on the Qing fleet. This was in 1839, the beginning of the First Opium War. Now, the British obviously won this war massively and decisively. And as part of the Treaty of Nanking in 1842, the British took Hong Kong for establishing a trading post and forced many Chinese ports to open up. Now, if you remember back in our own history in India, the different foreign powers were establishing different trading posts. Mm-hmm. Well, Hong Kong was one of those for China in this case. And side note, this is actually when the Chinese century of humiliation begins. That is, for the next 100 years, they were hammered by Western powers, apparently. So now one more opium war about 20 years later and lots of trading. And afterwards, we see that Hong Kong has become a very important trading post and later on an important financial center too.
Hmm. Yeah, so we fast forward to the end of the Second World War, which was this other relevant phase in Hong Kong's history, which we need to understand. So the Japanese had control over Hong Kong for that brief period during the Second World War. And afterwards, after the British defeated the Japanese, they decided to, you know, regain their control over Hong Kong and keep it, even as they were giving up their colonies elsewhere. You had Sri Lanka, you had other parts of Southeast Asia, you had India. And in fact, to deal with this global sentiment towards anti-imperialism and decolonization, they thought of introducing some form of representational democracy in Hong Kong to soothe things up. And Hong Kong remained a colony. But even as Hong Kong remained a colony, it saw hordes of Chinese people escaping China. When? This was when the PRC was established in 1949, and the Great Leap Forward was driving people mad without food and just scarcity. So they had to escape China and Mao's draconian policies to come live as refugees in an actual colony. These were called freedom swimmers because they were swimming to Hong Kong through the Victoria Harbour. By now, China, being China, had started, PRC being PRC, had started claiming that the old treaties that held Hong Kong under British rule did not hold any legitimacy. Just like they say that the McMahon line doesn't hold any legitimacy. This influx of cheap labor. Yeah, of course. This influx of cheap labor from China helped in the revival of Hong Kong's economy as Hong Kong turned towards becoming a manufacturing hub. But then with lots of labor also came labor camps, and some of them held ties to the Beijing government. This, along with the ongoing Cultural Revolution in 1966 and 67 in Beijing, set the stage for a scene that is all too familiar to observers of modern-day Hong Kong today. But it was still very, very different. 1967 saw large-scale riots and demonstrations in Hong Kong, just like today, and clashes between the demonstrators and Hong Kong police. However, the only difference was that in 1967, the demonstrators were demonstrating against the British, and they were backed by Communist China. Now you see the demonstrators proudly waving the Union Jack and protesting Communist China. At that time, in 1967, the demonstrators would gather in large numbers in front of government buildings with their little red books, like a large red sea of little red books. And suspiciously, they would gather there during work hours with that precision 9 to 5 time of protest, almost as if they were paid to protest, because they were paid to protest, at least during the initial stages. The riots killed more than 50 people.
Wow.
But the outcomes, yeah.
Isn't it like life comes full circle, like Beijing can dish it out but cannot take it?
Yes, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Oh. The outcomes at the time was that Britain introduced some sorts of social reforms to calm things down, and Beijing had started strengthening its foothold in the political landscape of Hong Kong. Some of these communist leaders who were leading the protests at the time started forming their political parties, which were backed by Beijing. By the 1970s, the Brits and the Chinese had started discussing the terms of the handover. And in 1984, they signed the Sino-British Joint Declaration. It was agreed that China would give Hong Kong some autonomy under a system which would be known as One Country, Two Systems, essentially trying to say that all this is PRC, it's just that some Chinese citizens have no rights and some Chinese citizens have a little more than no rights.
Basically, you can try to squeak a little bit when you want to speak, but not really speaking.
Yes. Just a little bit of luck. Anxiety started growing in the late 1980s when Hong Kongers saw what was going on in mainland China at the time with the Tiananmen Square massacre. You know, nothing happened in 1989. But yeah, nothing Hong Kongers, yeah, somehow they were just anxious. And gearing towards the end of the transition phase and towards the handover of Hong Kong to China in 1997. Hong Kong at this time was not a Chinese-controlled region, but it was already seeing signs of China exercising control over Hong Kong through, democratically elected representatives. The first chief executive, Teng Chih-hua, who was backed by China, not chosen by people, chosen by a sort of committee which was in some way elected, but, you know, again, the people who were standing for those elections were Beijing's favorites. So this guy, he had already signaled his intentions to curb protests, restrict political groups, and roll back political reforms, which were introduced by colonizers, the British, when he actually becomes the chief executive after Hong Kong is handed over. When the actual handover happened, Jiang Zemin repeatedly reassured the people of Hong Kong of the one country, two systems policy still in place. But then again, he also hailed the return of Hong Kong to the motherland as this glorious event and compared it to the dream of reunification with Taiwan. Something that
did
not.
The Chinese dream, right?
Yes. Yeah, it didn't go down very well with Hong Kongers and the Taiwanese, I imagine. And after the handover, the basic law, quote-unquote basic law, of Hong Kong came into effect. It was very basic because it said that, oh yeah, this is like a constitution for the people of Hong Kong. And it lays out the relationship between PRC and Hong Kong and gives very few rights to the people of Hong Kong. It was so basic that it said that, well, the actual authority rests with China. So, despite all the autonomy we give to you. And fast forward to 2014, when the Umbrella Movement was taking shape in Hong Kong and people were out again in the streets protesting the erosion of democracy, China decided to introduce some sorts of reforms to Hong Kong democracy. You know, they thought this would calm things down, but it did not. So, under the pretext of these reforms, the standing committee of the CCP decided that everyone gets to elect the chief executive, but the chief executive, you know, you could call him like a president of Hong Kong. The chief executive would be selected by Beijing, as in, you know, Beijing would select the candidates who can stand in the election to become chief executives. And then you can, as a Hong Konger, you can elect which one of these Beijing's favorites do you like the most. So that's not real universal suffrage, or is it? In fact, in this literal decision of the standing committee, there was a sentence, and I quote, "Chief executive shall be a person who loves the country," which is the PRC, "and loves Hong Kong." So much democracy, oh my God.
Yeah, you know what's rather interesting here?
Yeah.
You know the recent floating of the term selected?
I know, I was thinking that.
Selected Wazir-e Azam of our favorite neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Like so similar, isn't it?
Carrie Lam and Imran Khan, you know, were in a lift together.
Best couple ever. Really?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So now, the people obviously understood what's going on. I mean, they have been used to a very open democracy for a while, and they did not want the overarching arm of the CCP. They understand that the CCP views Hong Kong as part of China's inalienable territory and wants brutal control. Let me rephrase that. Hong Kong is still technically under control of the CCP, but CCP doesn't just want basic physical jurisdiction or control over the defense policy. CCP wants brutal, bludgeoned control over everything. That's the kind of an organization CCP has always been, or pretty much any major Chinese empire except the Song Dynasty. So that's why they want Hong Kong back to achieve its quote-unquote lost glory. And with this set of steps, the interests of the people would be, take a backseat, and the CCP's interest would be held up and held higher. So after that, the people failed to sort of block this legislation, but they still had the power to criticize the government and also criticize Beijing. And that was basically media freedom, that they had, like, they would not be arrested and taken to China for criticizing China. But in 2009, a set of steps taken by the wonderful chief executive and the governance, that proved otherwise.
Oh, yeah. And people were protesting this extradition bill, which would have allowed the undermining of judicial independence in Hong Kong, and it would have endangered these thousands of critics of Beijing who live in Hong Kong. And people were protesting this and were out in the streets in summer last year. The bill was eventually withdrawn in September, but the demonstrators, they continued to protest because they feared that the bill could be revived. And they now wanted for it to be withdrawn completely. And in fact, they started protesting against other things like police brutality. And they wanted a complete end of that relationship with China, of one country, two systems, because they were fearing the revoking of the basic law, which grants them that little autonomy that they have in 2047. Clashes between the police and the protesters had started becoming more and more violent, even after the bill was withdrawn. In fact, on China's National Day in October, an 18-year-old protester was shot and violence started ensuing on a large scale and continued for the rest of the month from campuses and on the streets. That month, in fact, saw the city's tourism drop by 56% from the same month last year, and the economy took a deep plunge. Later that month, the local council elections saw a landslide victory for the pro-democracy movement, with 17 of the 18 councils now controlled by pro-democracy councillors. But that really doesn't matter because, like I said earlier, most of the power is invested with Beijing, who selects the chief executive. So I don't know how much can the councillors influence anything with the CCP. What do the protesters now want after the withdrawal of the bill? They want that the protests not be characterized as a riot. They want amnesty for arrested protesters. They want an independent inquiry into alleged police brutality. And they want an implementation of complete universal suffrage, where they can elect whoever they want as the chief executive.
Awesome. And that technically means kicking out CCP from Hong Kong forever and ever.
Mm-hmm.
And as you might expect, Beijing doesn't like this even remotely. So Beijing will try to crack down on this as much as it can, because it's the CCP. So now that raises a question. Typically, we have known for the CCP to go for very heavy-handed crackdowns on wherever anybody tries to question its power. For example, in the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, apparently they killed some 10,000 people using tanks and machine guns, literally on civilians. Those were their own students who had very similar demands, actually. That is basic freedoms, free speech, etc. So why didn't Beijing do that on Hong Kong protesters is the fundamental question. So in our opinion, the prime factor is that China needs to maintain a cover of quote-unquote goodness to be able to trade with the rest of the world. A Tiananmen Square-style crackdown would have resulted in the world hammering sanctions on China and possibly even breaking trade ties. So they need to maintain that perception so that they can trade with the rest of the world. And that's basically a problem for China, because if they lose trading, they will be screwed, in other words. Now, you might think that they can still do it and not tell the world about it, sort of try to cover up the information as they have done in the rest of the China before. But the case is in Hong Kong is that the media is still largely free, that things get reported and social media is still active. Facebook is not banned. Or maybe it is, I don't know, with the situation right now. But the fact is that they cannot really hide it. And also there are other reasons. I don't know how big they are, but there are other reasons. Like, for example, Hong Kong is a financial center and still relevant for a PRC whose financial system is not doing well right now. And that is relevant, and they do not want that sabotaged at all.
Yeah, and what is happening right now, you know, now that we're talking about, oh, you know, fist bumps are not okay and we all must do namaste because any kind of contact with people is bad. Obviously, people in Hong Kong are not going to come out in their millions onto the streets to protest against Beijing. And the authorities are taking full advantage of this situation, which has been brought upon by the coronavirus. And the authorities have been detaining the pro-democracy leaders as the protests have subsided over the fear of coronavirus outbreak in Hong Kong. But that has brought about a new problem, which is that these the Hong Kong administration, too afraid of making Beijing angry with, say, their coronavirus precaution, you know, of, say, shutting all entry, all borders with China, or maybe offending China by saying that China, the Chinese people are bringing coronavirus into Hong Kong. So the people are not happy with the way the government is handling the situation. And they, in fact, have been, there have been cases where some people have been planting bombs in certain areas to force the government to shut border completely with the mainland.
Wow.
In fact, the pro-democracy activists suspect that this poor handling of the coronavirus outbreak, where, you know, some, like Hong Kong, like some other countries which are very friendly with China, have been too afraid of taking steps to prevent the outbreak from spreading in their countries. So these activists suspect that the anger might build up even more against the government, and you might see bigger protests as the outbreak subsides over time.
Wow, that would be a very interesting thing to watch in the upcoming days.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. If we all survive.
Yeah, if the virus doesn't kill us all by then. So, yeah, that's all for today, folks. More on China in our next episode, where we will be covering the infamous province of Xinjiang and the persecution going on against the Uyghur people. Do send us your feedback and comments. We will be linking our Twitter below in the description. Also, feel free to send us questions that you would like to see addressed. If you like this podcast, do share the link and subscribe to our channel. So until next time, see you and thank you.